Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Truth and Movies set sail today. Is Johnny Depp all washed up? We'll discuss Pirates of the Caribbean, Salazar's Revenge, and ask the question, is piracy killing movies? From sharks to Scandies, there's more than one Finn in The Other Side of Hope, an absurdist comedy drama about the refugee crisis from director Aki Kaurismäki. And in the film club, it's Aussie crime drama Animal Kingdom. Also, we'll be talking to David Jenkins, almost certainly from the deck of an oligarch's yacht, as he brings us all the latest from the Cannes Film Festival. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello, everyone. So I am Nick Dunkoff. I'm filling in for James Richardson this week, and it's a great pleasure to be here with Simran Hans.
Hello. And
also with Adam Woodward.
Hi. Adam,
as you know from listening to the podcast previously, of course, is the digital editor of Little White Lies magazine.
Yep.
And I always like that idea of you being a digital creation.
Yeah.
Like you're basically like the Tron-style editor of Little White Lies.
Yeah, I'm pretty deep in the system.
Yeah, into the grid.
Yeah.
Simran, you're part of the Little White Lies extended family, aren't you?
I am.
Whereabouts would you put yourself on the family tree? Are you like a black sheep cousin, some kind of wayward aunt, some kind of...
annoying little sister? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess I'll let Adam decide that.
And where else can we read you or hear you?
You can read me in the Observer New Review. I'm a film critic over there.
That's exciting. So Sunday's made. You can listen to Simran on a Sunday. You can listen to her anytime. You can read her on a Sunday. We should also talk about the listeners, because we've had some correspondence since last week, which is great. Thank you for your emails. If you want to email us, we'll give you the email address in just a minute. Let's see what I had. What I'm going to say is a semi-lengthy email from Jamie Lang, but that's the point of emails. If you want to keep it short, you could just use some other kind of forum, couldn't you? But he does say, or she, there's been some conversation this week about whether our correspondents are male or female, and Jamie could be either. I enjoy the show. I want to wish you the best of luck. I have been and will be tuning in every week. Thanks for the hours of entertainment each week.
Literally several hours so far.
Several hours. You make walking my dog far more enjoyable than it might be otherwise.
Well, that was our goal, I think, in starting this podcast.
I think the era of podcasts have sort of corresponded with when legally you had to pick up dog poo.
Yeah.
So I like to think that those two things have cancelled each other out. In the old days, going for a walk with a dog was okay because you didn't have to do that. Mm. Since you have to do that, you need the plus. And the plus is Oz. We sort of counterbalance.
That's a very beautiful thought.
Dog
I think.
Poo.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you imagine a pair of scales, we're on one side and the dog poo is on the other. Yeah. Chris B got in touch. An avid Irish listener here of your Truth and Movies podcast with James Richardson. Not this week, bad luck. I have genuinely really enjoyed the first four shows of this nascent podcast. So who knows? Chris B, today could be where it all ends for you, but let's hope not. Let's talk about the first film this week and the big release this week. And I'm going to say straight away, I don't understand why Pirates of the Caribbean Salazar's Revenge is called that in this country. Because everywhere else around the world, it's called Pirates of the Caribbean Dead Men's Shoes. Do you think that's a better title?
Do you think it sounds too much like Pirates of the Caribbean 2 Dead Man's Chest?
Is that what the other one was called?
I believe so.
But why would they do that in the rest of the world? Maybe they didn't call the second one what they called it here.
You mean there's a sort of alternative Pirates of the Caribbean mythology?
There's
here
a
in the
whole,
UK.
Yeah. There's basically a sliding doors thing going on with Pirates of the Caribbean, where everybody gets one title except us.
I'm reading here that it was originally called Dead Men Tell No Tales.
That's it. Something like that. There's dead men in it.
I don't know where the shoes come into it though.
Yeah.
There's not really much in the way of shoe-based.
No, I don't know where I got the shoes from, to be honest. The next thing we normally do is talk about the plot, but I'm not even sure I can remember the plot of this. Anybody want to give the plot a stab?
Well, the brief synopsis is that Captain Jack Sparrow is back.
Yeah.
And he's riled someone up, he's ruffled up a few feathers, as he usually is, up to his old tricks. In this case, it's Javier Bardem's Captain Salazar. How do we say it? Salazar?
Salazar is definitely how he says it.
With a bit of sort of slime or something falling out of his mouth.
A lot of Jack Sparrow.
Jack Sparrow. You will soon pay for what you did to me.
No, there's no need to bother, really.
Karina!
I have no time to chat, because my map just ran away.
I will be waiting for you.
Why would you be waiting for me?
The scenes where Johnny Depp and Javier Bardem are performing together, I found pretty incomprehensible.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, how long is it since the last one? It's like 7 years, I think.
It's 6 years since the last
one. And what I'd forgotten is quite how incredibly mannered Johnny Depp's performance is. And I'm absolutely not prepared to go through the previous four films and see whether it's something that's progressed over time. But I mean, I guess it is. My memory, as you see, is that the first film, I remember thinking that I quite enjoyed it for what it was. Big summer blockbuster. It was nice to have pirates back. There'd been a long gap between pirate movies, and it felt like something at least, you know, entertaining enough. But it was such a thing, it's so many diminishing returns on all those sequels that I sort of thought, well, surely after 7 years, if they're bringing it back, this is a fresh start. And I think, haven't they called this a soft reboot? Whatever
I think
that means.
Perhaps because it has a different directors and also a different screenwriter, which is maybe why they're calling it a soft reboot, if indeed they are calling it that.
It's a funny thing as well, isn't it? Where it's, you know, Captain Jack Sparrow looms very large on the posters and all the publicity, but ostensibly they try and make it a story about the other characters. So it always used to be, or at least to start off with, it was Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley.
Yeah.
And in this movie, what we do get is two hot young things. I mean, that's, you could describe it another way, but that is the point of them. The guy is it Henry Turner?
Yeah.
He's played by Brenton Thwaites, who is, you know, objectively speaking, a fine-looking man.
Yeah, he's strapping, handsome young man.
Definitely strapping. And his love interest, I suppose you could say, is played by Kaya Scodelario, who actually, you know, she's a British actress.
Yeah.
Came out of this what's starting to look like the Skins school of showbiz training, because she was in Skins, and like a lot of other people, she's gone to bigger things. And she was in The Maze Runner as well, wasn't she? And I actually thought that she was really good, both in The Maze Runner and in this. I think she normally sort of goes beyond the material that she's given. I don't know what you two thought.
I've got my problems with her. I think this whole character, Karina Smythe, I find that they've sort of plonked her in there as the clever one. And, they've tried to kind of use her being the smart one. So basically in the movie, she's an astronomer and a horologist. So she's kind of knows about clocks and she knows about the stars. And she's the one who kind of leads them to the treasure. And she's meant to be the one with the brains, but she's also the one with the boobs.
Yeah. And she's the only woman.
She is. Well, no, there's
There is a woman who is literally made to look like a fat pig that Jack Sparrow has to marry as a punishment.
Yes, and there's also the mystic character as well.
Yeah. So basically, you've got a woman made to look like a fat pig, a witch, and the lead female character. So it's not great, is it?
It's not, and I just think that trying to make this Kaya Scodelario character the smart one is just a really pathetic attempt to dismiss any charges of sexism.
I think that's
that
all it's there
the
for,
film.
Isn't it? That's why they give her that backstory, don't you think? The other thing, you mentioned that she's a horologist. It seems to me the only reason they said that she was a horologist is so that all the other pirates could make jokes about how it sounded like whore.
Yeah.
Which is fairly, I found fairly distasteful, to be honest.
It's a little bit crass. I mean, that is the level of humour they're going for with this. I actually think the film is not without its merits, though. I think there's an amazing opening practical effects-driven sequence. I mean, it's something like out of a Buster Keaton movie where they rob a bank and that's kind of the reintroduction to Jack Sparrow. And from there, it kind of goes downhill and falls back into the kind of blue screen, green screen mire that we're used to.
I mean, it is an interesting question because about how Johnny Depp is going to carry on in his career, because it's an odd time for him, isn't it? I mean, Johnny Depp, apparently this movie was slated originally to come out a lot earlier than this, and it was only the disaster of The Lone Ranger that made them push it back. Of course, then there was all those troubles in his personal life, but then, of course, he's also now attached to the Fantastic Beasts franchise, so maybe that's what's going to save him. What do you think?
I think it's really the franchise that's finished him, if it's my take on it. I just think he was a character actor before, yeah. and you kind of think of him in all these different roles. And, you know, obviously he collaborated with Tim Burton a lot, but the roles are fairly distinct.
Yeah.
And then after this, he's just played a version of Jack Sparrow in every movie that he's been in.
Yeah. There was a time, it just makes me seem terribly old, but there was a time before Pirates of the Caribbean where people used to say, when's Johnny Depp going to have a hit? Because he was, like you say, just a character actor who everybody really admired. But of course, the curse for Johnny Depp is he's also, or at least was, fantastically good looking. So he was never going to be able to sit in that character actor, those roles in movies forever. He was always going to get offered these big parts. But I think it's an interesting point, the fact that maybe it spoils it. Orlando Bloom does get a bit of a moment in this movie.
Or Barnacle Bloom, as I like to call him.
I'd forgotten how bad he is. Is that awful?
I think it's a little bit unfair. He's probably not as a high-profile an actor as he might have been, but, I mean, he's been in the Lord of the Rings franchise and this, two of the highest-grossing franchises ever, so he's done something right.
I think maybe he suffers from that Johnny Depp thing as well, which is that he's become associated with big franchises and he's found it difficult to escape from that, because I think he probably wanted to get away from Pirates of the Caribbean and they've sort of dragged him back into it.
Just a quick note, I wanted to mention the directors. I don't know whether this film will go on to make money, you know, do well at the box office comparable to the rest of the series. I really hope that it does, just so that these directors can go and do something else, because they made a film in 2012 called Kon-Tiki, a Norwegian film, another sort of high seas adventure, which presumably some bigwig at Disney saw and thought, right, these are our guys. But they're decent filmmakers, and I think they do invest this film with a real energy, and ultimately I think it's a bit too big and convoluted for them, and they kind of get smothered by it a little bit.
It's unwieldy, isn't it?
It is unwieldy, but I like them as directors. Joachim Rønning and Espen Sandberg, their names. Apparently they're childhood friends from Norway, and yeah, I'd like to see them do more.
Do we want to mention the celebrity cameo, or should we move straight on to the ratings?
Well, I think we should just say that Paul McCartney has a brief cameo in this. It's amazingly not the worst cameo in the film.
I thought he was better than Keith Richards was last time round.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about ratings? Simran, I'm going to come to you first.
Sure.
What do you think?
So I guess for anticipation, I'd have to give it a 1, because I am actually allergic to the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. Uh-huh. So I wasn't looking forward to it. But I want to say, like, you're never rooting for a film to be bad as a critic, ever.
No, of course you're not.
You're always kind of going in wanting to get something out of it. And really, I got nothing. For enjoyment, I would maybe give it 2, because I kind of had the opposite take as Adam. I found, like, the first 3/4 of the film absolutely exhausting, just drivel. And then the kind of last maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, I was kind of into. There's a really great set piece with a sort of glittering island. I don't really want to spoil why it glitters, but
I didn't understand why it glittered, I don't think.
I thought it looked cool. And then there's also a kind of underwater fight sequence at the end, which I think works and is kind of a bit visually different from all of the stuff on the ship, which is just this kind of murky, quite ugly looking action sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there is a kind of attempt at an emotion, getting at kind of like an emotional nugget towards the end. It's a bit corny, but I think it at least is going for something that's more than these kind of trite jokes that don't really work and don't really land. I give enjoyment a 2. But in retrospect, I had to have to give it a 1. I'm sorry.
I will match your anticipation and in retrospect scores, but I'd actually give it a 3 for enjoyment. So 1-3-1. Just because I think my expectation was so low.
It's quite a leap in the beginning.
It is. I had a bit of fun with it, and I wouldn't watch it again.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the bottom line, isn't it? We're going to talk about The Other Side of Hope, which is the new movie from Aki Kaurismäki, Finnish director. Could I leave it to you, Simran, to talk about the plot in the most basic of terms?
So it's basically about a Syrian asylum seeker who decides that he's going to make a new life for himself in Helsinki. And it's also about a sort of parallel story with a Finnish... He's kind of a salesman who decides that he's going to leave his wife because she's a drunk, and he plays some poker, wins some money, and decides he's going to buy a sort of fixer-upper restaurant. And their lives kind of collide in quite a funny way.
We should say Aki Kaurismäki, he's been making films for a long time. His first one was 1983. But maybe he's best known for his last work, which was in... Le Havre. But even that's 6 years ago. He doesn't exactly bang them out, does he? But they have this kind of absurdist vein running through them. If you've never seen any of his films, they're not quite like anything else that you'll ever see, are they?
They're not. And you're right in saying that he doesn't bang them out. And that's a really good thing, I think, for him. He's someone who I like. I don't know that he's someone I think about very often. He's not a filmmaker I would necessarily, you know, go and pick out of my DVD collection or whatever. But every time a new film of his comes around, I'm really excited for it. This one is the second part, along with Le Havre, in his Harbour trilogy. It's interesting seeing him essentially present this response to the refugee crisis in his sort of typically droll, deadpan way.
And I think that's what struck me as being really brave about it, isn't it? Is that to deal with something like the refugee crisis, normally we'd only be used to be seeing that in a kind of social realist vein. Mm. And so to see someone like this director who generally deals in things that are shot in what you'd call a slightly non-realistic manner, that deals with dialogue, and he brings out these deadpan performances from his actors, and a lot of the dialogue is very absurdist as well. It's an almost non-realist portrayal of something that has to be dealt with quite sensitively, but I thought that it really worked.
I think it's really funny, and that's its great strength. You might expect a kind of drama about a Syrian refugee to be a bit bleak. And, and I think the humour is quite dark and there's kind of a gloominess to it.
Yeah.
But it's very dry. And I think anyone who kind of likes that dry wit will find a lot of sort of little laughs in it.
It reminded me a bit of sort of early Jim Jarmusch in that respect. That kind of dry humour, that kind of sly coolness, although all the people in it that play musical instruments are all really old. I was going to say, there's also this kind of almost kind of Lynchian. It's that kind of slightly at a slant way of looking at things. I mean, I thought it looked extraordinary for this kind of movie.
I think this is a really, as much as it is deadpan and it's got this humorous side to it, it's a really humane film as well. I found it really affecting.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's from this Finnish perspective, but it's very universal, I think, in the way it deals with the subject.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think there are some astonishing images in it. When Khaled, the Syrian refugee, you know, the first time we see him is you see a shot of like a dump of coal on the back of the ship and he rises out of it. It's an extraordinary image. The sets look great. There is a very distinct kind of Scandinavian feel to the way the restaurant looks, the brilliantly named The Golden Pint, and the way the costumes, the car, the main character drives this incredible 1950s American sedan. And apparently the set director and Kaurismäki have had some kind of enormous falling out about who's actually responsible for the look of the film, and they've had to change the way they're doing the credits.
It's kind of stuck in this time warp. You get this feeling like you're kind of in this maybe 60s, 70s kind of moment in time where the crappy restaurant where most of it is set has this incredible cartoon painting of Jimi Hendrix hanging on the wall, nothing else. And there's just something really endearingly crap about it, not about the film, but about the way that kind of set design looks. It looks deliberately sort of scrappy.
I think that combination of the way things look and these kind of deadpan performances and the dialogue means that when you do get those moments of humanity, it sort of hits you almost a little bit harder by having that remove. I mean, another director you could talk about who does non-realist movies is Wes Anderson. And people often accuse Wes Anderson of making movies that are slightly... don't have much emotion in them. But I think sometimes having that slight remove almost enhances that for you.
Yeah, definitely. And just going back to what you were talking about just now, A bit of a tangent, but I actually went to Helsinki for the first time last year as part of a work trip to sort of see how the Finnish film industry operates. Mm-hmm. And it was weird. Helsinki itself does feel like it's stuck in a bit of a time warp. Finland itself, I think, only celebrated its 100th anniversary as a nation like last year. Walking around, actually visited the bar that Aki Kaurismäki owns with his brother and various other locations from his films. And it did actually feel like I was in an Aki Kaurismäki film. It was great.
I think we should talk about the ratings for this film. It feels like we all liked it, but we're going to find out, and we're going to find out first with Adam.
I'd give it a full sweep of fours.
Simon?
I would maybe give it a 2 for anticipation. I hadn't seen Kaurismäki's other work. I didn't really know much about this film other than it was quite positively reviewed when it played in Berlin at the Berlin Film Festival earlier this year. But I didn't really have any expectations for it, and I really loved it. I'd probably give it a 4 for enjoyment and probably a 4 in retrospect, although I have seen it twice and I don't think it's quite as fun on the second watch. I got something quite different from it. When I first watched it, I saw it at the Glasgow Film Festival a couple of months ago, and I was really laughing a lot at the jokes. I mean, there's one sort of set piece involving some sushi, which I was crying with laughter at. But then on this second watch, I got more of the sort of pathos that they're getting at. And actually, it's quite downbeat in parts. Yeah. But I still give it a solid
humour. Humour sometimes needs an audience as well, don't you think? Watching something on your... I mean, I'm assuming you watched it on your own the second time round.
No, the second... So the first time round, I watched it with a sort of public screening with people who'd paid to see it. And the second time around, I watched it to review it with a bunch of critics who actually didn't seem to take to it.
Critics are notoriously quiet in comedies. They don't want to give anything away.
Some critics, yeah.
Not all critics, of course not. I don't want to tar all critics with the same brush. I'm sure some of them absolutely laugh their pants off. Up next, David Jenkins joins us from Cannes.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi.
Hey, it's Adam. How are you?
Oh, hey, how are you doing?
Yeah, good.
Good. I'm just out on the Croisette at Cannes, enjoying the films and the sun.
I saw your tweet earlier that described The Beguiled as a stone-cold masterpiece. Do you want to elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think in Cannes they have a kind of competition lineup, and it's sort of stretched over 10 days. And I think there is a sense that they put films in certain positions to... They know some films are maybe going to be a bit tougher than others, and some films are going to be a bit more, like, you know, universally enjoyed. And this The Beguiled, which is a new film by Sofia Coppola, is like smack dab in the middle. And it's weird because I wasn't maybe expecting to love it as much as I did.
Okay.
There was a trailer of it that sort of gave a lot away and maybe set up the tone as being a little bit kind of camp and kitsch. But no, it absolutely blew me away. It's like, I think it's the best thing I've seen out here, and for me, her best film as well. It's a sort of retooling of the sort of Don Siegel, Clint Eastwood film. It's about a Yankee soldier set during the Civil War who is found injured in a forest near a woman's kind of boarding school in Virginia in the South. And they bring him in to help him heal, and are kind of very instantly smitten by his kind of manly, macho vibe that he brings to the place. And then it sort of quickly turns into this very tense, you know, like a kind of, you know, sexual standoff almost, where you don't really know if he's kind of playing them or they're playing him, or there's this real sort of sense of danger. And you got Nicole Kidman in the lead as well, who's really, really good.
Okay, it sounds really good. Do you think it's an awards contender?
I mean, it's a weird one, actually, because this year there doesn't seem to be any film that you would say that you could say, yeah, that's going to win an award. Or last year there was a film called Tony Erdmann that played right at the beginning of the festival, and everyone was convinced throughout that that was going to be the one that won the big award. And then when it didn't, there was a sense of inevitable disappointment. I think for this festival, there hasn't really been anything that sort of galvanised the kind of press corps. I mean, there's not one thing that everyone likes. there's, I mean, I would love for this one to win the Palme. Personally, I think it's, yeah, as I say, the best, not just the best film in competition, but the best film I've seen in the festival. There's a film that is being tipped called Loveless, which is by the Russian director whose name I couldn't pronounce last week, and I'm not even sure I'm going to attempt to pronounce it this week. Yeah. So, that's it. I wasn't a massive fan of the film myself, but in terms of love that it's got from elsewhere, there's certainly a feeling that it could sort of go on and do something big come the prize giving on Sunday. It's a really sort of brutal and bleak film about a couple who are going through a divorce, and they don't know who's going to get their young sort of teenage son, and then basically something happens which sort of knocks their kind of petty arguments into a different realm, and it turns into a very different film where they're I don't want to spoil it, so yeah.
Okay, well, I know you've got a film to get to, so we'll let you get on. But I know you're back next week anyway, so we can have a quick rundown. But yeah, enjoy the rest of the festival.
Sure, thanks. See you later.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So each week in the Little White Lies Film Club, we talk about and recommend a classic film, a film you may have missed, or a film that's worth reappraising. And this week, we're going to talk about Animal Kingdom, because Australian director David Mitchell, Animal Kingdom was his first movie. He has a new film arriving on Netflix called War Machine, starring Brad Pitt, Ben Kingsley and Tilda Swinton. So we all sat down, watched Animal Kingdom again. It's his debut feature from 2010 about a criminal family from Melbourne. It stars Guy Pearce, Joel Edgerton, Ben Mendelsohn and Jackie Weaver, many of whom you will hear in this clip from the movie.
G'day, Josh. I've got some bad news, mate.
Who knows the bad news?
Is everything okay here?
Yeah. Everything's great.
You all right, mate?
He's fine, Mr. Leckie.
Josh, I'd like you to come down to St Kilda Road with me, if that's okay.
Hey, what's he done? Tell me, I'll make sure he gets disciplined.
Will you come with me, Josh?
Well, what do you want to talk to him about? Talk to me about it.
We'll speak to you again at a later time when we're ready.
I might have some information for you about those two murdered police. I've been asking around a bit and there's a few theories floating around, but I don't know if any of them are true or not, but I might be able to help you with your investigations.
Oh, thanks for that. Will you come with me, Josh?
You go, love. I'll call Ezra. Go put your shoes on.
So what's great about doing this feature, or at least what I've enjoyed about doing this feature this week in particular, is that this is a movie that, although it came out in 2010, that is 7 years ago now. And so really, all I remembered about it was that I liked it and that it was Australian. And also, what was notable about it was that this also became famous for being a bit of a star-making film. So although Ben Mendelsohn had been around, anybody who knows Australian cinema or Australian TV for that matter, because I think Ben Mendelsohn did appear in Home and Away or Neighbours at some point. They all do, don't they? Although he was really sort of noticed by everyone in this, went straight over to Hollywood. Of course, now he's in Star Wars movies and Batman movies and who knows what else. Guy Pearce was sort of already famous, but still doing his Aussie work. And Jackie Weaver, who stars as the matriarch of this crime family, she got an Oscar nomination for like the next film she did after this. So it's got this reputation as being a film that launched people's careers, hasn't it?
Yeah, and of course you could say it launched the career of David Michaud. How do you say his name?
I'm just going Michaud? I'm going with Michaud.
I think it's Michaud.
Michaud.
You're going to go with Michaud? I know is it a circumflex over the O?
It's got an accent.
A roof, one of those little roofs over the O.
Yeah.
Michaud.
I think he's just put it in there to be pretentious.
There's no business like Miss Show Business.
It says, it screams art house director, doesn't it?
Yeah. So loads of people got in touch with us about Animal Kingdom, which is great. It seems that there are lots of fans of this movie out there. Simran, do you want to read us one of the messages that we got?
Yeah, I quite like this one from Ken Bowes, who said, it really is chillingly fantastic with some incredible performances. And I'm not just saying that because it's set in Melbourne. I'm guessing this guy's from Melbourne. He says, I also really liked David Michaud's follow-up, The Rover, though the critics didn't. Although this critic did like The Rover.
Yeah, The Rover's great.
There you go. We also had Des McDougall said on Facebook, great film. Anthony Partos' soundtrack is something very special, haunting and menacing like the film itself. Adam, have you got one?
Ben Keeler says, loved it, as well as his follow-up The Rover, which we've discussed. Been hearing wobbly things about War Machine. We'll be checking it out in a couple of days when it's on Netflix.
We should say a little bit about the plot of Animal Kingdom, apart from the fact that it's about a crime family. Can I hand it over to you, Adam?
Yeah, it opens with a sort of quite upsetting scene of a young man watching daytime television.
Deal or No Deal.
Deal or No, the Australian version of Deal or No Deal.
Yep.
And his mother has died of a heroin overdose next to him. And, it's done in a very sort of matter-of-fact way.
I think the opening of it is just devastating. And it's an absolute masterclass in exposition.
Yeah.
So normally you have to get so many characters talking to each other about what's happening around them. And yet you see this kid sitting on a sofa, watching the telly, his mother slumped next to him, ambulance men come in. Very quickly you realise that his mother overdosing is probably not something that he's not used to. And then seconds later, he calls his grandmother and he says, my mum's died, what am I going to do? And she says, I'm going to come and find you. And he says, do you remember where I live? And in that one line, you know that they're estranged, that there's some reason why the mother and daughter have fallen out. All this stuff can, in another film, take pages and pages of dialogue that's not very interesting. I think it's just brilliant how quickly it immediately sets it up. And so he goes, this 17-year-old kid ends up living with his grandmother, hilariously named Smurf, played by Jackie Weaver, and this kind of motley group of brothers. Is Joel Edgerton one of the brothers, or is he just like a kind of surrogate family member?
I'm not really sure.
I think he's like a family friend.
They've all got these. They've all got nicknames, like you mentioned, Smurf. Mm. Ben Mendelsohn's character is called Pope.
Yeah.
So yeah, they all have this like. There's a hint of this connected family, but you're not really sure exactly where they all fit in together. But.
Yeah. And it's clearly dysfunctional from the off. In fact, there's a lovely scene where he is with the family, and Joel Edgerton seems to be reasonably sensible. Another of the brothers is clearly off his head on coke the whole time, and yet still, even though you know that there are these misfits in this family, Jackie Weaver's character is immediately slightly odd. There's something disquieting about the fact that she behaves around her sons.
She's really creepy, and as I was kind of mentioning to you guys earlier, it really kind of I don't know, made me feel quite sick the way that she kisses all of the boys on the mouth, all of her sons. She kind of It's almost a snog, actually.
Yeah, it's overly intimate.
It's quite graphic, and it makes you kind of think, what's her relationship to them? What's the power dynamic going on?
I think there's something also that's helped by the fact that she's really quite small. So what she has to do is, with all her sons, who are mainly quite hulking characters, she has to actually put her hands on the side of their face and pull them towards them for that kiss when she gives them a kiss, and it immediately sets you off. But despite the fact that all these characters, you're immediately aware that they're a bit odd, they still talk about this other brother, Pope, who we haven't met yet, in kind of hushed tones, that Pope is basically laying low because they're a family of bank robbers, which again we've learnt in a really pithy way just by David Michaud showing black and white footage of a bank robbery over the credits. So you never actually see a bank job, but you know that they're bank robbers. And then this character Pope, played by Ben Mendelsohn, appears, and he sort of sucks all your energy towards him, doesn't he? If anybody's seen the series that he stars in on Netflix, Bloodline, it's sort of the same part that somebody clearly saw Animal Kingdom and went, he is really good at playing a black sheep of a family, and he does that again. But that is not a complaint at all. I think he's absolutely terrific.
Yeah, it's a brilliantly cast film, this. And someone I don't think gets a lot of credit normally, simply because the others have gone on to do sort of bigger and better things, is James Freshfield, who's the young...
Who's the kid, yeah.
Yeah, protagonist in it. And what I love about this film, I think voiceover in terms of exposition is often quite a tricky thing to get right. And yeah, I think he uses it masterfully here. Actually, compared to his new film, War Machine, which we'll come on to later, the voiceover technique that he again employs there is very sort of overused and quite stodgy, actually.
Well, traditionally, if you hear a voiceover, it can be shorthand for they didn't really know how to tell the story here, and so they put a voiceover on to kind of paper over the cracks. But that voiceover, like, that doesn't actually come until after that, those initial scenes where they've dealt with that kind of exposition brilliantly. So you know that he's on top of it. He's just using that voiceover, for the right reasons.
I think what he really gets right is the sort of pacing and the tone of it. It's a thriller, and it's kind of punctuated by these moments of violence that are really quite shocking. And even though I'd seen the film before many years ago, I watched it again recently and just still found myself kind of gasping every time there was this explosion of kind of horror on the screen. And it's just, it's very tense. It's kind, it's called Animal Kingdom because the family are kind of like a pack of animals. There's something quite tribal about them. There's even some quite explicit references to the title with them sort of running through the long grass and the fields outside where they live. People kind of being hunted like animals and hunting like predators. So it's quite, I guess, obvious, the metaphor, but it kind of works.
Well, there's a natural order to their unit as well, isn't there? There's a hierarchy. And as the characters essentially get snuffed out, James Freshfield's character, he sort of takes his place in the family tribe, basically.
The sort of main thread of the movie is this push and pull, though, between him and his crime family, who he's never been involved with before his mother died, and a policeman, Lecky, played by Guy Pearce. I think Guy Pearce actually gets a speech about animals and their pecking order and how you have to, side with the strong rather than the weak. What do you think about Guy Pearce in this movie, aside from the fact that he has a moustache that my wife and I argued over the merits of, and I won't tell you who was on which side?
I'm pro-moustache.
I was pro-moustache, I'll tell you now.
I think he's really great in this role, and I quite like seeing him in that sort of straight guy.
Yeah.
Kind of cop, like good cop kind of role. Yeah, I think it works for him.
It is interesting to talk about David Michaud and, the way his career has progressed since then, because as we were saying at the beginning, many of the actors in this basically just immediately decamped to Hollywood and done amazing things, or certainly well-respected and presumably very well-paid things since. But it's been quite interesting what's happened to his career. So second film was The Rover, which I know you're a fan of, Simran, aren't you?
Yeah, I remember seeing it a couple of years ago in a very small, sweaty screening room in Cannes, and everyone was quite excited about it. And actually, the reception coming out of that screening was quite lukewarm. But I was really into it, and I think this was around the time where Robert Pattinson was starting to get interesting. Mm. He'd done Cosmopolis, the David Cronenberg movie, but I think people were quite mixed on that. And then he sort of was in this, and he was also in Maps to the Stars at the same time, and his performance in both of those films is quite weird. Yeah. There's a really great bit in The Rover where you've just got him in a car singing the Kerry Hilson song Pretty Girl Rock, which is really up there in terms of my pop music movie moments.
And we're talking about this because David Michaud's now moving on to this movie on Netflix, which is called War Machine. What do we know about War Machine?
War Machine is, as the title suggests, it's a political satire about American militarism. It's set during the war on Afghanistan and follows Brad Pitt's character, who's a sort of highfalutin general, doesn't really know what he's doing in terms of his counterinsurgency efforts. But he's surrounded by these yes men and basically has a lot of power, doesn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah.
What's interesting about this film, I think, is that David Michaud, as we discussed in Animal Kingdom and The Rover, is such a great director of actors. Mm-hmm. And in this film, Brad Pitt just kind of does his own thing. He really runs with the character.
And he's the producer, isn't he?
He's the producer as well. But it feels like David Michaud didn't really have much input on that. I think ultimately this film is going to, your enjoyment of it or people's enjoyment of it will likely fall on whether they like Brad Pitt's character or not.
It's also actually being bold. It's a comedy, isn't it? Which we haven't really seen David Michaud do before. We know he does this kind of intensity really well, and he does violence and crime really well, but comedy's a new area for him.
What I want to know is whether the Brad Pitt character in this film is a mashup of his role in Burn After Reading and Fury.
I mean, that's basically
exactly
that
accurate?
It. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of Brad Pitt. I think he's a really underrated actor. I think he does what he does exceptionally well. And I think he's generally a force for good because he gets a lot of movies made outside the Hollywood studios. And also he's never taken the money to be in a big superhero comic book adaptation. That's a shrinking number of actors these days, isn't it?
Yeah, he does like to get his sticky fingers all over sort of the productions that he's involved in, though. I think there's a bit of self-interest there, a bit of smugness that sometimes manifests in the films.
That's the worry. But Animal Kingdom, we absolutely recommend unreservedly. Do we know what we might be doing next week on the Little White Lies Film Club?
We do. So we're going to do The Beguiled, not the new Sofia Coppola version, but the original Don Siegel 1971 version. And the reason is that obviously Sofia Coppola's new take on the film is just screened in Cannes. So in anticipation of that film coming out, I thought it would be interesting to revisit this film. It's also Clint Eastwood's birthday next week.
Happy birthday, Clint.
And in Cannes, he presented an anniversary screening of Unforgiven, and he hinted that he's going to be returning to acting.
So that must be the 25th anniversary of, I think it's 92, was Unforgiven, so I guess it's the 25th. Oh, gosh, goodness me.
Yeah.
I think I prefer him as an actor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I think definitely. But that's not to say that he hasn't made some great movies, but maybe less consistent as a director.
Yeah, he's definitely more consistent as an actor.
So that's The Beguiled on next week's Film Club. Don't forget to get in touch with us on Facebook or on Twitter. Tell us what you think about the Clint Eastwood version of The Beguiled, or in fact, anything else at all. Email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. At this point, I should say thank you very much to Simran Hans for coming on the programme.
Thank you for having me.
And I would say thank you to Adam, but Adam, you're here more often than me, but thank you anyway.
It's a pleasure, as always.
And it's been an absolute pleasure for me. And let's play it out with part of the score from Animal Kingdom. Des McDougall, I've read this out earlier on, but he says the soundtrack to Animal Kingdom is very special. And here is a piece of that. Thank you for listening. We'll see you again next week. And this was a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.